Welcome to Sandwiches and Regular Hours, episode 158 for April 6th, 2021. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Essenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we are still in the future here. This is the future. This is the Ministry for the Future, published in 2020 by Kim Stanley Robinson. Today we're discussing part two, chapters 30 through 53. What have we learned so far, Pam?
Oh my goodness. I still don't know. There's so much going on in this book. I feel like now that we're 53 chapters into the novel, we should be able to clearly identify its genre, you would think. So let me ask you guys, what do you think is the genre of this novel? It's so unusual.
It is definitely not a cohesive, singular narrative. And that certainly draws our intellectual thinking about the whole. As it's hard to pin down the genre because it doesn't switch genres as such chapter by chapter, but it's definitely different each chapter, but maybe not the genre. I don't know, Pam.
It's an ambitious work. It's trying to somehow capture the zeitgeist of its time. It's got a lot of hubris. There is some arrogance involved in it, and certainly it takes a Thomas Mathis view of the world, like somehow, you know, if we only woke up and got to really understand it, everyone would come to the same conclusions.
Interesting.
So, yeah, I really like that comment because it feels like it basically narrates, you know, from 2020 through the next few decades, right? So we got to 2032 in this part, and it's going to keep going. So usually we would, like, usually science fiction is where we narrate the future, but it's definitely not science fiction. Doesn't feel like science fiction at all. This changing genres every chapter, the many, many, many chapters with movements between, that kind of reminds you of postmodern literary fiction, where you have this sort of reflection on what you're writing as you're writing it. I think in the end, it's probably best read as a utopia. And this goes, Chip, to your point, that it's kind of dealing with economics, politics, philosophy, health. A little bit of character development, but not too much. And it's really a book of ideas. A book that says, exactly as you just said, Chip, like, if we could all agree, we could imagine a better future. And of course, the utopian genre is always doing two things. Number one, critiquing contemporary society. And number two, imagining a better future. And I think this book is trying to do both of those things. We can talk about how successful it is. So I think it's a utopia in the end, but I'm open to what you guys think on that.
Do you think it switches genres chapter by chapter? Or do you think it's just, like you said, a list of ideas that are not necessarily coherent, but in the same realm? But I don't know that it switches genres as much as it's writing style. Does that make sense?
Definitely. Definitely. And that's what to me, it's either postmodern literary fiction or utopia, but I think probably the utopian impulse is stronger. This is a book that's trying to make a difference. We can argue whether it succeeds or not, but it's definitely trying
to present
impact, change the real world through its analysis.
And what they didn't realize is the Georgia Guidestones have been here for so long. They have the answer for us, Steve.
Yes, we've talked about this many times. Pam, are you familiar with the Georgia Guidestones?
I am not.
These stones in Georgia that list all of the things that we need on Earth in order to be successful.
After humans do not get wiped out, there will be a group of humans that may survive.
The post-apocalyptic.
Yes, and they have arrived, and they are on the side of the road, to help the world at that point. Nobody knows who put them up, but they're very important, or at least they think they are.
Oh, is this a literally?
Yes, this is a literal, actual.
Oh, I've never heard of this.
Look up the Georgia Guidestones, and
okay.
you'll have what the future will hold.
Yeah, we've come to that idea a couple of different times in all of our readings of the future, and the idea of apocalypse, and if we humans survive whatever mass extinction event, those rocks will survive, and they have in them the knowledge that you need for post-apocalyptic living. Not like the road where you just walk and cry with your son and hope that you find... Oh, the road. Oh, those of you who haven't seen that movie yet, I recommend it, but at the same time, it is a hard journey, that movie.
I mean, I always say it's the best book I'll never reread.
Oh, boy.
And maybe it's a good time to go ahead and listen to Pink Floyd's The Wall as you're driving. Let's just go all out on this.
All right, Chip, let's go to your area of expertise then. This section of this book talks a lot about economics. I read through this and I didn't take any notes, Chip. I was hoping the whole time that you would explain all of the concepts or debunk all of the concepts that are presented in this area.
It definitely took a critique of what they would say is the modern Chicago view of Chicago School of Economics and the Austrian School of Economics. And in fact, the idea was that somehow we can, through accounting, we can solve everything and everyone will follow the rules and everything will be hunky-dory if we could just get our grips around it. As opposed to what the Chicago School and what the Austrian School would say is that each individual is like their own little person, maybe making their own personal decisions. And through that, we end up having the direction on things should go. This is a very top-down approach to it. I think it's got a lot of the ambitions of the computer science industry and what they would like to do and some of the things that they can use to tighten up things through models and stuff like that. But it also has an arrogance to it that somehow a group of enlightened people somehow know the future. And that seems to be a real, real problem, because what we've seen in the past is that entrepreneurs who come up with ideas on how to use technologies and how to use things, you know, they just shotgun the world forward. And if we look at history as, you know, living in poverty and squalor, and then, you know, 250 years ago, when we finally stopped demonizing people for trading with each other, and somehow we get this explosion of wealth in the West that certainly has dragged humanity up to the point we are now. The question is, you know, are we coming to a post-accumulation phase, at least here for, you know, I would say in the West, United States and Europe, where the rest of the world is still trying to get, you know, refrigeration in your home and air conditioning, which historically would be the wealthy of the wealth right now. I mean, I think in the United States, I can't remember, you know, like 98% of the people have indoor plumbing and 96% of the people have access to televisions and electricity and, you know, all these comforts that, you know, that the rest of the world would like to have. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I think that there's a lot of interesting critiques that are brought up here. I do think that they are explored a little bit, but certainly they can be naive at times.
I really like that idea, Chip, of the post-accumulation society. Is that somewhere that we're going? And certainly that's something that Robinson is seeing. And I feel like that's something that I'm seeing and hearing from people younger than myself too. So, I mean, we're in a very interesting moment. Now, a couple of things I wanted to talk about and ask your opinions on. So one of the things he does is structures history around war and economics. And that's pretty typical. And I used to teach a pronunciation class for people who were working on their English. And when we talked about early 20th century, and you think about the sort of four big markers of the first half of the 20th century, we have World War I, super hard to say if English isn't your first language. Then we get the Roaring 20s, which are, of course, the time of great economic prosperity. Then we get the Dirty 30s, the Great Depression. And then we have World War II. And this was like the best pronunciation lesson, but also it's a way that we structure our understanding of the first half of the 20th century. Now, what Kim Stanley Robinson does here is when he talks about the 21st century, he thinks of the 2020s as the trembling 20s. So in chapter 30, he says, is the feeling of things falling apart massively entrenched? Is that, and that's such an interesting question. Like, what are the 2020s going to look like? And we don't know. We're just at the beginning. But like, so far, it's not fantastic, right? I mean, as we just entered 2021, it hasn't been so great. And I kind of think like that trembling 20s is interesting, that notion of things falling apart and people uncertain what to do. And then he talks in chapter 51, he says the 30s were zombie years. Civilization had been killed, but it was walking the earth, staggering towards some fate even worse than death. It was interesting because some years ago, I remember giving a paper about zombie banks and how metaphors from speculative fiction like zombies and vampires get used in understanding in the financial news. And there were all these articles about like zombie banks in the Wall Street Journal. And I sort of analyzed them from a pop culture literary point of view. And this notion of like the Walking Dead in economics, this was in 2008-09. And so I kind of love this idea of like, what do you name your decades? But I don't know, like it's purely speculative at the same time.
And that's the point. We don't know. Right. And the idea of anticipating things get worse is it, if you look at the book, was it Factfulness that was written a few years ago, Bill Gates recommended it. The whole premise of that book is that we look at these things like, oh, we live in this wonderfully terrible time. But the answer to that is we don't live in a terrible time. Yes, we're in a pandemic, but historically speaking, we're in a pretty good time. In fact, not in just a good time, we're in a great time. And assuming we can get out of this pandemic, hopefully it's better.
It's so funny how I don't even worry about the pandemic. It's the climate crisis that really concerns me.
Because the numbers for the pandemic, they're certainly fluctuating. Some days they're up, some days they're down. And the feeling that, boy, I would love to get out of this, I am doing everything I can, that individual bottom-up versus the top-down approach, where do we find the solution to this issue versus the climate crisis, which is much more global, that is not just one group of people who are overusing, although we could speculate that there is one group of people that is overusing, and the individual versus the top-down approach. The uncertain is isn't that always the case for every present?
It's always the case. Everything is uncertain. History is a time of uncertainty. It's always been uncertain. Okay? Humans have lived in famine to famine, war to war, poverty, death. This has been part of human existence forever. We are finally crawling out of that in history. And we're at the very beginning of this point. So the idea that somehow, you know, what do we see with wealthy societies? Well, the wealthier societies you get, the fewer children families end up having. You know, at one time you had to have 10 kids because you had to have them all work the farm. Mm-hmm. Most of you are not on farms now. And if you're having kids, you're choosing to have 10 kids. But many of the families are much, much smaller now. And in fact, in some European countries, they're putting public service announcements out begging families to have children because they're looking for their tax base at some point in the future. Denmark's one of them. So, I mean, the idea, the climate issue could be a really serious issue. I mean, in fact, every university I'm aware of is forcing their student body to go through some form of class to discuss climate crisis.
Because they are and the future of it, for sure.
Right. And as someone who is working on, who has worked for the past 10 years on UConn's curriculum, I would just say, like, we the administration or faculty aren't forcing students. Students have begged us for these classes and have begged to make them a requirement, certainly at UConn, but also nationally. This isn't necessarily a top-down thing. This is something that students are really desperate for. And I think part of the issue with, like, pandemic versus climate crisis is that we know how to deal with a pandemic. We can look in history and see various pandemics. Some lasted much longer than others. We have much more medical information. I mean, the way that we've created this vaccine is very impressive, et cetera, et cetera. We don't know how to deal with a climate crisis. It's not like someone has the answer and we just have to follow this. Like, we honestly, it's what's called like a wicked problem. I mean, people really, really don't quite know how to deal with it. You know, there's lots of ideas out there. And I think that's one thing that I feel like Robinson does really well is kind of show the vast range of ideas that people have in dealing with this crisis, and then the lack of agreement on any specific idea.
Well, if it only took 10 million people from India to die to bring them together, to be able to work together. I mean,
20 million people in that heat wave, yeah.
That certainly seems like crappy logic to me.
That we should be able to get together on this problem before that?
That the people of India would require 20 million people to die to be able to come to some kind of consensus on how to work together.
Well, I
instead of maybe having a caste system that oppresses a group of people.
I wish we could come to a consensus to get this done without that, for sure, but that's very challenging. There's so many approaches. There's so many different ways to try, and trying to get everybody on board, trying to get everybody to decide to do this without that impetus, I don't know how it's going to happen.
We incrementally are doing it as things... in fact, as we were preparing for it, I mentioned that if you're a city, doesn't matter which city, and you're getting ready to replace your lighting, your street lighting, are you going to put LEDs in?
Yeah.
LEDs use significantly less electricity than what's currently being used. As you rebuild infrastructure, you can rebuild it in a situation where it is more energy efficient and things like that, because it lasts a long time to do that. Mm-hmm. There are parts of communities right now that are being built. I was in Richmond, Virginia last year, and there's a whole community that is in downtown Richmond that is all working off solar. It's 100% solar. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're going to build a house today, are you going to incorporate some of the technologies of the day that are going to be more energy efficient? And then as you get scale, those things kind of work their way through it. So if I'm an area, maybe like China, who is doing a tremendous amount of building, certainly China could impact the market because they would have scale to be able to drive prices down. And that's what we end up finding as early adopters pay a lot. And then over time, it gets spread out to the rest of us. I mean, pretty soon, think about just the calculator that was introduced to you, Steve, when you were in school, was, I don't know, $150. And now you can get one for, if you could get one for a dollar, you can get one for a dollar. Mm-hmm. I mean, they pretty much, they virtually give it away now as an app on a phone. So, I mean, that's how market-based economies work.
And that argument reminds me of David Boyd's The Optimistic Environmentalist, which I read a couple months ago, which had like all these examples of, you know, small scale, from small scale to large scale, but things that haven't yet had a huge impact on carbon emissions, but that are like making small incremental moves. And that there are a lot of them, and that as they start to become the norm instead of the exception, they will have an impact. And I feel like that idea is kind of in contrast to what Robinson discusses in chapter 40, Jevons paradox, which is that with more efficiency, we also get more use. So as you get better car mileage, you also get people driving more as you get better. And so there's this sort of paradox. And what the narrator argues in that chapter is that we need to change the outcome. This is going back to Chicago School economics, right? We need to change the outcome. And instead of saying the economy works for profit, we have to change it to biosphere health. And it's an interesting idea, not like a brand new idea or anything, but I kind of like the way he laid it out. Quote, If economics is a method for optimizing various objective functions subject to constraints, then the focus of change would need to look again at those objective functions, not profit, but biosphere health. And I'm really fascinated by that idea. Like, to what degree do people hold on to profit and accumulation as the thing that we want to maximize versus the health of the planet and perhaps the health of the people? It's a great question. And I don't know. I don't know where we're at with that.
I would push back a little bit on that, because you use the word profit as in it as an accumulation of money or something of that nature. And while that certainly could be an aim, it could be satisfaction, could be happiness. It could be something that's far more challenged to measure. That could be the challenge of the writing that you're pulling that from, or he's pulling that from. But it really is one of those areas. This is exactly, it goes back further than the Chicago school. It goes back to, you know, Adam Smith wrote that. He wrote about the theory of moral sentiments, who basically was writing of how to live a good life. And this idea that the good life is destroying your environment is probably not the good life that we're describing it or trying to envision it. So, I think it's more complicated than just portraying the Chicago school as profits only. Although it could, you know, I've been in those classes, I've met with them, it's kind of a shorthand of way of looking at things, but it really
right. is. It's something you can measure, whereas you can't. I mean, our happiness quotient aside, it's really hard to measure happiness. Yeah.
Well, the way you do it it's always relative to something else. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's when people ask me, how are you? I always answer, compared to what? What is your scale?
It makes you really popular, Steve. I think people love that answer.
They do, because I'm adorable.
How are you? Fine.
No, I don't say fine. I will never say fine if you ask me how are you. If you ask me a question like, how are you? You are going to get a diatribe of some sort, whether I'm positive or negative that day. There's going to be a conversation. Fine is never the right answer for me.
Now, Steve, I bet you like chapter 42, where Janice Athena is meeting with Mary, and we briefly go into Janice's brain, and Janice is thinking, oh man, it is so hard to explain this idea about the carbon coins to computer illiterate people. And then it's like, it's just a great way, because I know, Steve, you always say that people start saying numbers and you kind of...
100%.
And so I love that we get it from the perspective of the person with the numbers, who's like, oh God, I know that people are going to start to glaze over as I talk about these numbers. But what did you guys think of the idea of the carbon coin, of actually having this currency that measures your environmental impact, you know, rather than an accumulation model?
Well, there's never been a black market anywhere, so this is a great idea.
Okay, so yes, certainly that is mentioned in here, that the idea that some people will certainly cheat the system, and you can't police the system, so the system will be fraught with peril of people choosing not to follow it.
Corruption? Uh-huh. Oh, maybe a little bit. Uh-huh. Just a little bit.
Yeah, that is mentioned in this section, but the idea of setting a system where there is a good reason to follow it, the carrot, and punishment for not following it, the stick, and finding that equilibrium was intriguing to me in the idea of the carbon coin.
It seems so naive. The idea that somehow, well, anyway, it doesn't really matter. I just think it seems, it's very naive. I think that this is something that's been... batted around for a number of years with carbon tax and all sorts of stuff. And as we've learned over the last month, that's how Tesla makes their money. So, you know, it's not electric cars. It's basically selling carbon credits.
Correct.
Oh, how lovely for the taxpayers of the United States.
I can't disagree with you, but I think that having a system of rewards and punishments is the only way to get this to work. I don't think there's any intrinsic motivation for certain people to change their ways. They don't see the global issue. They are very self-centered on, this is the way things are, I'm going to get what I need, versus helping others.
So if you're going to make something that's going to be intensive with energy, are you going to go to a stringent country or a less stringent country?
I suppose that you are going to find the least expensive way to do the thing that you think is the best for the...
And that could be. That certainly could be part of the answer right there. It could be least expensive.
And unless you start getting credit for actually being environmentally sound, and then people buy your product because of your carbon footprint instead of against it. So like, that's the thing. I mean, it's about changing the incentives, right? So, I mean, I may be naive or I may be optimistic, but I think this idea has some merit.
Is this the fatal conceit? I don't know. We'll see. This idea that somehow we can, through accounting, we can kind of make it all better.
Mm. Well, and I guess one thing I do like about this book is this sort of understanding, and I just like it because it matches my own, that the only way we're going to deal with the environment is if it meshes with the economic system instead of being against the economic system. Like, you have to figure out how to put those two things together, how to make environmentally sound also economically sound.
And you, a socialist, I mean, certainly it would fit your view of how society should work.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
But we do get some interesting questions of ethics in this part of the book as well.
It was interesting for me. Chapter 32 really like had me pause, because I really recently read Robin Atfield's A Very Short Introduction to Environmental Ethics, which was the first time I had ever heard of this idea of evaluating how much, how much we need to, when we make ethical decisions, think about the people of the future. And there's sort of this, chapter 32 has this very actuarial perspective on like, how do you discount the needs of people who don't even exist yet? Not something I had ever thought about, but kind of an interesting way to look at it.
Yeah, I glazed over a lot on this.
Yeah, but the idea, I totally get that.
The idea of the discount was interesting to me. How much do you discount future for today? What do we need today for whatever we need, and how much is that going to impact the future? And you're going to focus on today, and you're going to discount the future. I got that. Then there were numbers.
Well, a very realistic way of looking at this, as opposed to looking at future generations that may or may not be here, would be how much debt can a current generation throw on a future generation?
Absolutely.
Thomas Jefferson, certainly didn't have computers like we have computers, but he said 10 years. You should be able to pay off your debt in 10 years.
Which is not at all how most countries are living today.
So we're at $22 trillion, exactly, which no one can imagine. Yep. We just took another $1.9 trillion on to work with COVID. So what are we, $24 trillion?
And what's our GDP, 14? 14.5?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
So the point being is, how much in a... Listen, there's no Hitler in the world today. I mean, we're not fighting a world war. Mm. So what at this point, how much should we be able to put on our grandchildren?
Hmm.
How much debt should they have to carry to subsidize today's generation? Hmm. That's a real question. That's a legitimate one that we have. This the question on who's going to be here in the future and what we owe that group of people. That one's a little more esoteric, because it's really hard to say who's going to be in the future. I mean,
yeah.
Our population, it will not continue to grow as it's grown.
Right.
If society becomes wealthier, it will at some point hit its maximum amount.
Mm-hmm.
How we use resources certainly will be impacted by what's available at the time. Humans have been incredibly industrious at using what's available at the time, and history has shown that pretty well. And if it doesn't work out, there will be a mass death of humans or a reduction in how, you know, how we procreate and all that other stuff. We're already seeing the impact of that in male sperm counts and things of that nature right now.
Right. And I think that I just saw something about like 2020 was the first year that the U.S. didn't have replacement population.
But here's what the U.S. can do is we still import people.
Right. Exactly.
Market based economies require growth in population. And we're still an area that's attracting people to it.
Right. And young people. Yeah.
Just not Illinois.
You're correct. Illinois is losing population.
Yes, right. Yes, we are.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but I think there are a lot of really interesting ethical questions here, and I'll be curious what you think, but some of these are just like, they're really raised as questions to get the readers thinking about it. I don't think they're really answered. So chapter 39 is such an interesting one.
Because it's the best chapter in this whole book, Pam. Chapter 39 is the best chapter that Kim Stanley Robinson has ever written, ever. I've only read 53 chapters, but chapter 39 is it.
Tell us why, Steve.
Because they find a group of people that they kidnap them and they force them to watch cheesy movies. The worst they can find. La la la. This is movie riffing. There's movie riffing in chapter 39. They take the people at Davos. They kidnap them by gunpoint, hold them at gunpoint, and make them watch terrible propaganda films about climate change and about all of these things. And the people, the narrator in this chapter, says they were making fun of these movies the whole time, and they didn't even have robot sidekicks.
So on the grand scheme of thing, the ethics of it is, you know, if we can terrorize a group of people and somehow that will, you know, the ends justify the
trying
means.
Trying to how lovely that.
Instead of trying to convince them, maybe in the world of ideas, we're going to,
hold them at gunpoint. Trying to brainwash people.
Because, right. And then in terms of how the narrative is set up, like, obviously the people who, you know, the eco-terrorists who do this action, they have a specific idea.
They're just terrorists. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do eco. They're just terrorists.
Okay. Well, typically they would be categorized as eco-terrorists. I mean, that's an actual type of terrorist that I think we see a lot in this novel, but we can just call them terrorists if you prefer. But either way, these eco-terrorists, they actually, they kidnap people and they have this idea of how it's going to work. And then our narrator is like, oh my gosh, this had no impact on us at all. Mm-hmm. Afterwards, like, we sold our story to the papers. We just went back to our normal lives. And the final sentence of this chapter is, so, effect of this event on the real world, zero. Mm-hmm. There's a bit of an expletive, which I won't use.
Well later on, when we get the group sending drones out, taking down planes, because, you know, if you can't make a point that way, why not just go right down to, you know, terrorism again?
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's the other kind of terrorism we see here. Another would generally be classified eco-terrorism is the children of Cali who organize Crash Day because they feel like, well, not they feel like, because indeed 20 to 25% of our carbon is in transportation. So they actually organize a terrorist activity where they take down like 60 planes within just a few hours. I mean, the destruction of that is obviously horrifying, and I don't...
Much more effective than QAnon.
Well, this is terrorism. We can't argue that this is not terrorism.
And I don't think the novel is saying it's a good idea, but I think the novel is suggesting that these are some of the kinds of terrorism that we might be seeing in the next decades.
And maybe we can be sympathetic to it.
I don't think so. Do you think the novel was saying we should be sympathetic to this? I didn't read.
I think it's part of just the, I think it was just one of the solutions, as in they'll take a multifactored approach.
I think it was I think it was considered a bad solution though, right? Like I don't think that the novel condones terrorism. Do you?
I don't think it had a problem with it.
Oh, wow.
I disagree.
Ooh, wow. Interesting.
Wow.
Oh, I thought it did. And I thought that part of the evidence of it is that, like, the Davos thing where people are like, wow, that had zero impact. Terrible idea.
Well, the kidnapping of all the rich people certainly didn't have an impact. But yeah, the children of Kali taking down planes with rich people seems to have gotten some notice. I guess there's no military intervention to protect this, or maybe we learned that it is the military that's doing it.
Mm-mm. No, this is a terrorist, I think. Yeah.
Hmm.
So that's interesting. So I definitely thought the novel was against terrorist approaches to climate change, but was acknowledging that those are things that are currently happening in small ways and may well happen in larger ways as part of the climate crisis.
It is multifaceted. There are a lot of things, a lot of ideas in this book, and I don't know whether or not Kim Stanley Robinson wrote this piece to tell us that this was a path to changing the climate crisis, but he said that it's within the realm of possibility that this could happen, that somebody could choose the more violent, more terrorist routes.
And I guess I feel like he's suggesting that the Ministry for the Future, the bureaucratic route, the boring one, I think is the one that he's actually, that the novel is proposing as the better route. At least that's how I was reading it. Like, Frank is a really, really wounded character. And, so when we get, like, Mary, I think, is like someone who's following appropriate channels and has a much better chance of succeeding.
And we get a little into the Stockholm syndrome that we had not discussed last week, but the idea that Frank kidnapped Mary and then Mary feels like she should listen to Frank. And she wonders, as the narrator in that section, is this Stockholm syndrome? Is this my mentality? Because he kidnapped me, I feel like I should listen to him. Or is he really making a good point? And that's some very
complicated psychology, right?
That very, very complicated.
Yeah. And it's funny because in these chapters, it's like we haven't even talked about our characters and we're like 40 minutes into our podcast, because that's the kind of novel it is, right? It's a novel of ideas. So let's close with our characters. So we have the Tunisian refugee camp. We have the return a few times to the child who by the end of this section has been there 1,859 days because their country has been flooded out. And so they're in this really tough situation. They've met Frank, who's an aid worker now. Then when we follow our two main characters, Frank was at that Tunisian refugee camp for a long time, and he's just too traumatized by his experience in the heat wave. He tries to be a father, tries to be a partner. He's really bad at both. He's attracted to both philanthropic work and also like lower key eco-terrorism. I don't think we get the sense that he's, you know, bringing down planes, but he has been kidnapping people. Obviously, he tried to talk to Mary. He tries to stay away from cameras. And then he ends up at the end of this section getting captured when he tries to break up a fight between the refugees and these Swiss fascists. And then the Swiss officers are like, we're really sorry, man, but there's a warrant out for your arrest. Like, thanks for getting involved here, but we have to arrest you. Hmm. And then Mary, who we've been following around to all these semi-boring meetings, trying to do the good work and not really succeeding all that well. At the end, she ends up meeting with Frank again. And it's interesting when she goes to the prison to meet with him. I had heard of Stockholm syndrome, but I had not heard of Lima syndrome, where the kidnapper becomes sort of changed by the kidnappee. Had you guys heard of Lima syndrome before?
Not by name, but logically, yes. I could see how the interaction between those two groups, one group could be influenced by the other. But no, I had never heard it named as Lima syndrome.
Yeah.
I'm going to agree with Steve. I had not heard it.
Okay, yeah, me neither. So this was interesting. In this section, we kind of close in Mary's mind. She was the one in power now. Briefly, she touched him on the shoulder, almost as he had first touched her on Hakkestraas. She was partly there for revenge. She felt that now. He was warm through his shirt, hot, feverish, it felt like. He shrugged her off like a horse shivering away a fly. End of chapter. Hmm. And I kind of liked the complexity of that moment where, you know, this middle-aged woman, almost 50 years old, is like seeing this much younger, much more idealistic, but super wounded man. So this middle-aged bureaucrat and this kind of idealistic aid worker, but who's like now a criminal. Mm-hmm. And the two of them both kind of have the same vision of a future world in which you don't have the oceans rising at 5 millimeters per year, but they're both kind of impotent in front of, mm-hmm. of the challenge as well.
And that's something that we've discussed in our household a lot, is there is no real difference between groups of people. We all see the same issues. The difference is our approaches to fixing those issues. How can we solve whatever minor problem we have in the household versus the huge global issues? If we both acknowledge that there's a problem, we can both try to work to solve the problem. The terrorist approach is probably not the right choice for me. I don't think that that will solve any global issue. But the bureaucratic approach is slow, is glacially slow.
Maybe too slow.
If it's effective at all.
Right?
Correct.
Yeah. I kind of like chapter 38. I kind of hated that chapter, which is, I don't know, maybe somebody's radio show who's saying, today we're here to discuss potential alternatives to the global neoliberal order. And it's just this guy talking and he ends up saying, like, why aren't we doing anything? And he says, it's because of constipation. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, you just have to push harder. And it's this, And he actually says, like, within it, wow, what an ugly metaphor, but maybe it's the right one for the sort of inactivity and like lack of movement on this issue, which people are starting to really understand.
Well, I can't speak for the rest of the world. I mean, our governments were established to be this snake pit. Mm-hmm. They were designed
stronger than I expected, but yeah.
I mean, and even on that, you know, you look at the federal government, you have the three seats of government, and they share the power. And then you've got state governments in the United States that theoretically have similar powers. They can fight back. And then you have your local governments, you know, from the county to your town or city. By design, they've been been set up so you're going to have slow change.
Mm-hmm.
When we look at situations where, look at executive rule from the president. The idea that war should be declared by Congress, mm-hmm. but we seem to be interfering in a number of places. Mm-hmm. Those are through executive orders, and the question is that a violation of how our government was established? Mm-hmm. I would argue it is. But hey, these workarounds, every time that there's more power given to a group, leadership, it's not necessarily for the good. I mean, for every good thing that can happen, you could have bad things happen too. So I'm not sure that, and then you throw it, you make it even more challenging when you throw in other governments mm-hmm. and their needs too.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the climate crisis is a global crisis, so it absolutely has to be dealt with by all the governments of the world. And it's hard to imagine how that happens.
Yeah, that's constipation right there.
Right.
It's a great metaphor. It's an ugly metaphor.
It's an ugly but good metaphor.
It's where we're at. The idea of how we get things moving and the glacially slow movement of how this is to be done, that's a wonderful, awful metaphor.
Are we ending on constipation? I think we must.
And that's the book club, folks. Good night, everybody. May all of your movements be as painless as possible. So we are moving forward or downward into the next part of this book. Next week, we are reading chapters 54 through 69. We are going to be halfway done with this idealogue, this ideology of this book.
Bill and Ted probably have something to do with how we end this.
You and your numerology. You and your numerology, Chip. Yes, chapter 69, dudes.
It took me a moment to get that one, Chip. Forgive me. Very slow this morning.
It wasn't that fun.
You guys, I'm actually reading a really interesting book by Jack Halberstam, The Queer Art of Failure, that does a great analysis of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, as well as a Dude, Where's My Car? And those movies very seriously. So anyway, I'm not saying that I'll make you guys read that, but wow, it's kind of fun to think of these movies as, you know, having insights one wouldn't otherwise have.
Oh, yeah. The depth of analysis of Dude, Where's My Car? Great. We'll watch your social media to hear more about that, Pam. Oh, boy.
Oh, dear.
I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week.
Pam, do we have any information from these chapters, or do we have too much information?
We might have too much information. We'll see what happens, right? But I think we will survive at least one more week.
All right, there we go. We would love to hear from you. What do you think? Where are you at in all of these ideas? How are you thinking about these global ideas, these small problems that you can solve, and these big problems that you can't? But boy, we got to try, don't we? We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4867. Send us an email, sandwiches@irregularhours@gmail.com. Our website is sandwiches@irregularhours.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. So's Pam with her Dude, Where's Your Car analysis on her Twitter account. You can watch her. Yeah, there you go. We're on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and YouTube. I want to thank you again for listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenplug.
And I'm Pam Vidor.
We'll see you in the future.